Good morning and welcome to another episode of Cure Talks. I'm Priya Menon, your host, and today we are discussing the evolving treatment landscape of psoriasis with Dr. Joel M. Gelfand from the University of Pennsylvania. On the patient panel, bringing us the patient perspective, are Howard Chang and David Stanley. A warm welcome to all. If anyone has any questions for Dr. Gelfand, please feel free to submit them on the page you're listening to the show or email them to priya@trialx.com. You can also dial in using 718-664-6574 and ask your questions when we are live here today. That is 718-664-6574. We would like to hear from you and would be on the lookout for questions throughout the show. So getting on with the discussion, we have with us Dr. Gelfand, Professor of Dermatology and Epidemiology at the Perelman School of Medicine, University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Gelfand, such a pleasure to have you here.
It's great to be here, Priya. Thank you for having me.
I'm going to start with some very basics to lay the foundation of our discussion. So could you please begin with what is psoriasis and some of the known causes?
Well, you know, fundamentally, psoriasis is an autoimmune disease where what happens is that under the influence of genes we inherit from our parents, and this is multiple genes that come together in combination, if you will, that makes our immune system sort of susceptible or primed to act in what we call an autoinflammatory or autoimmune manner. And so what happens in people who develop psoriasis is that some trigger comes on. In some cases, it's a strep infection. In other patients, it may be something that we don't even know what triggered it. And the immune system gets confused, and it starts reacting to proteins that are normally made by the skin, by the epidermis, and thinks these proteins are foreign or abnormal. And so the way our bodies evolved over time was to say, you know, if there's something wrong with our skin, just flake it off. And so that's what happens in psoriasis. The immune system thinks there's something wrong with the skin. It releases substances, we call them cytokines, and they cause the skin cells called keratinocytes to proliferate very rapidly. So a normal skin cell takes about a month to be born. In psoriasis, the entire skin will turn over in about a day or two. And that's why patients are stuck with having, you know, these large plaques in their skin that are very thick, that could itch, that could crack, and can bleed.
Why I'm going to be asking this is we've got a whole lot of questions on psoriasis, and one of the questions, I think a couple of them actually touch upon the genetic inheritance of psoriasis and go on to ask if psoriasis can be inherited. So is that one of the causes that people have psoriasis?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it can run in families. About 40% of people who have psoriasis will have a family history of the disease, which means actually the majority of people do not have a family history. And that's, again, because the genetics of psoriasis are quite complicated. It's multiple genes that come together in combination to make one prone to developing this problem when some other environmental trigger comes into play, whether it be an infection, other risk factors have been demonstrated for psoriasis are things like obesity, for example. Those who are overweight have a higher risk of developing psoriasis over time. And there's been some studies showing that major stressful life events, a death in a family, a divorce, can also trigger psoriasis in people who probably have some type of genetic susceptibility. For those who have psoriasis, I like to reassure them that if they have children, it's not like their children are destined to develop psoriasis. The lifetime risk of parents who have children, their children developing psoriasis when the parents have it, is probably around 20% or so. And the severity of psoriasis, the inheritance of that is pretty complicated. Typically what you'll see is maybe if the mom or the dad has pretty severe psoriasis, if the child develops it, it's usually more of a mild case. And so I hope that information reassures people who are living with psoriasis that the likelihood that their children will have to face the same degree of severity is pretty low. And also, we're making so much progress in this disease state that we increasingly have better ways of managing this disease over time.
So is there a classic or typical age range for onset, or do we see it across age groups?
Well, psoriasis can occur at any age of life. It could come on shortly after birth, in the neonatal period. I've had patients develop psoriasis for the first time in their 80s, in the setting of having a major stressful life event, the loss of a sibling. So this can occur at any point in time. Now that said, generally disease most commonly comes on in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s.
And how different is pediatric psoriasis from the adult onset?
Well, I think biologically, pediatric psoriasis is quite similar to adult psoriasis, and responds to treatments fairly similarly to adult psoriasis. So it is essentially the same disease. In general, when the disease starts earlier in life, it tends to be more severe for patients, more extensive over time compared to those who develop psoriasis later in life. But that's sort of an average situation. Each patient's journey is highly individual when it comes down to it.
Dr. Gelfand, I'm going to take a few more seconds and dig a little bit more about pediatric psoriasis because we know that we have quite a few caregivers of psoriatic patients listening in today. You were, I believe, part of the team that released the pediatric psoriasis guidelines in November this year. So can you briefly explain some of the main points of these guidelines so that listeners get are informed about this?
Yeah, so I think these are pretty broad guidelines, and they speak to several different issues around the care and management of psoriasis in children. They highlight for the first time some of the comorbidities that people need to be aware of in children with psoriasis. Obesity and metabolic syndrome are particularly prevalent in young people who develop psoriasis. So their caregivers should be aware of this and follow appropriate guidelines for identifying things like high blood pressure in children or checking for diabetes or abnormal lipids the way they would in any child, recognizing that the results are more likely to be abnormal in a child who has psoriasis, especially when it's more significant. The guidelines also outline the various treatment approaches we have for psoriasis, ranging from topical medications, ultraviolet light phototherapy, pills that have been used for a long time, like how to use safely things like methotrexate, and then also outline the data emerging for our newer therapies, biologics, medications like etanercept or ustekinumab, which have been approved in the pediatric population for use in these patients.
So how does treatment options differ for children as compared to adults?
Well, that's a good question. I think with children, what's a little more ch several things are more challenging in children. One is oftentimes a lot of our treatments, which are quite expensive, have not been proven to work in a pediatric population or don't have FDA approval, and therefore it could be very hard to get access to some of these therapies. The second issue is that parents, rightly so, are often very cautious about what treatments we're going to use in a child, especially when we don't fully understand the long-term safety of some therapies on a young individual. Now, that being said, there's a lot of uncertainty in life in general, and specifically in the world of psoriasis. And so, for many children who are suffering with psoriasis, not treating the disease is really damaging as well. It has severe effects on self-esteem. There's higher rates of anxiety and depression. It may interfere with their development in terms of their ability to focus in school. If they have a lot of itching or sleep disturbances from their psoriasis, may affect their social well-being, their ability to make friends, and things of that nature. And so clearly, in children who have psoriasis, it's impacting them in terms of the physical symptoms or emotional symptoms or social symptoms of psoriasis. We have a variety of ways to treat that disease effectively. It's been thought that some of our therapies are probably even better tolerated in children. So methotrexate classically seems to be safer in children than in adults in terms of effects in the liver, although that's somewhat anecdotal information and is not definitively known to be true. Some of our therapies that we use in adults, like a drug called acitretin, a form of vitamin A, that could cause issues with bone development, and so we tend to shy away from using that long-term in children, whereas we'd be more comfortable using that long-term in adults. Ultraviolet light phototherapy is often highly effective for children with psoriasis, but may be very difficult to do if the child has school or after-school activities, making it hard for them to get into the office three times a week. We're trying to address this issue by including children in a large pragmatic trial we're doing called the Light Study, where patients 12 and older are randomized to get treatment with psoriasis with phototherapy either at home or in the office. Also, if they're a very young child, they're 5 years old, they may have a hard time standing still, inside the phototherapy booth, and so it may not be so appropriate in that age group. Coming to biologics now, are more novel therapies, things like etanercept, used aconitumab. These are approved by the FDA for use in a pediatric population, so they're very effective approaches. But we keep on making progress in psoriasis. Other mechanisms of actions, like the IL-23 inhibitors, such as risankizumab or tildrakizumab, or the IL-17 inhibitors like secukinumab or ixekizumab, these drugs have yet to been approved for pediatric psoriasis, and therefore clinicians will often have a hard time accessing these therapies in that age group because they are prohibitively expensive.
What are some of the standard of care treatments other than those you mentioned now for pediatric population? I want to know for the adult population, and I'm sure our panel of Howard and David will have more questions on treatment for you, but if you could just briefly just touch upon some of the standard of care treatments that adults are offered currently.
Yeah, so I'll talk to this by categories because, we've been so lucky to have so much progress in psoriasis in the last decade or so that we now have, more than a dozen treatments that are, considered to be standard of care. And a lot of times how we decide what treatment to use with the patient is based on shared decision-making with the patient, what the patient's preferences are, what their treatment goals are, what their underlying health comorbidities are. So do they have significant psoriatic arthritis? Do they have other medical problems they've been dealing with, like have they had issues with inflammatory bowel disease? That's pretty common in people with psoriasis. Or do they have a strong family history of multiple sclerosis? Sometimes we see that in people with psoriasis. Have they had a recent malignancy, and does that influence the treatment approaches that they're willing to use? So broadly speaking, we have a variety of topical medications that we tend to use when disease is fairly localized. Just a little bit on the elbows and the knees, maybe a little bit on the scalp. When the disease is more extensive, getting to be more than 5% of the body's surface area, and you can think of this as the palm of your hand. If the palm of your hand is basically about 1% of your body's surface area. So if you have psoriasis that you would need 5 of your own palms to cover, it's very burdensome for patients to be able to put on topical medications regularly when disease gets more extensive. So when disease is more extensive or not responding to topical medications, we have three categories of approaches. Ultraviolet light phototherapy, the most classic one being narrow band phototherapy, which is highly effective. We have targeted versions of narrow band phototherapy called excimer or laser, which is very effective for localized small plaques of psoriasis. An older modality is called PUVA, where people take a pill by mouth that sensitizes them to sunlight, and then they get ultraviolet A phototherapy with it. We don't use that as much anymore because it's inconvenient for patients, but in people of color, darker skin patients, it's a very safe and very effective approach to use. Then we have pills by mouth, methotrexate, acitretin, cyclosporin, and then a newer medication, apremilast. And apremilast is currently fairly popular because you don't need any laboratory monitoring with that medication, and that makes it much more convenient for patients. Its downsides are that it's expensive, so it can be hard to access. Its efficacy is sort of modest. If I gave it to, say, 10 patients, About three patients have a good clinical response, the rest not so much. And people could have some nausea, queasiness with it, some diarrhea that could be uncomfortable. That usually goes away, but some patients have to stop the medication for it. And some patients, about 1 in 100 patients, will complain of feeling depressed on that medication, and then we just stop the medication that occurs. Our newer biologics, injectable medications, we have basically three flavors. Those that target TNF, which have been around for 2 decades now and are especially beneficial for joint disease, psoriatic arthritis, I should say. They also, depending on which one we're talking about, could work for other conditions like inflammatory bowel disease, Crohn's, ulcerative colitis. We then have things that target IL-23, either specifically, like three of them we have is risankizumab, tildrakizumab, and guselkumab, or non-specifically, which would be ustekinumab, which blocks both IL-12 and IL-23. Ustekinumab also is approved for treatment of Crohn's disease, so often useful in these patients with overlapping diseases. And then finally, we have three IL-17 inhibitors. That would be secukinumab, ixekizumab, and brodalumab.
I think there's quite a lot of new drugs out there for psoriasis. Dr. Gelfand, I'm going to take some audience questions now since we are on the topic of treatments, and you did mention phototherapy as well. We have a question asking, is phototherapy offered as first line of treatment, and who qualifies for it?
Yeah, so well, we're going to learn a lot more about this as we do the light study. And for those who are interested, you can just go to www.thelightstudy.com, and it's L-I-T-E, where we'll have a better understanding of how clinicians and patients actually choose to use ultraviolet phototherapy. Generally speaking, it's patients who have psoriasis affecting visible areas, arms, legs, trunk. There's a lot of disease in the fingernails or the genitals or the scalp is severely involved. Phototherapy is not so great in those situations because the light can't penetrate to be effective in the nails or scalp, and we tend to not treat the genitals because that could cause burns or potentially skin cancer over time in men. So generally, you're speaking of patients who have psoriasis affecting at least 4 or 5% or more of the body surface area in areas that are amenable to being hit by the ultraviolet light. We have special versions of ultraviolet light phototherapy where we could treat the palms and the soles. Those areas are often very difficult to treat, so we use a form of topical PUVA in that circumstance, where we put a medication on the skin called Sorolin that sits on the skin for a period of time, and then we shine ultraviolet A light. And that's a pretty effective treatment for psoriasis when it affects the palms and soles. Finally, there's another variant of psoriasis called guttate psoriasis, where people tend to be covered with these very small spots of psoriasis all over the body. That responds very well to phototherapy as well. And as you can imagine, someone could have these little tiny 5 millimeter size spots of psoriasis all over the body. Their whole body surface area may be small if you add up all those little spots, but it's almost impossible to treat that with topical medications because you've got so many spots all over. And ultraviolet phototherapy is very helpful in that circumstance.
So phototherapy seems quite an interesting topic here because we have more questions on that from the audience. Someone wants to know, what are some of the possible side effects of phototherapy?
Yeah, so let's just speak about what we call narrowband phototherapy. This is essentially a single wavelength of light in the ultraviolet B spectrum. This wavelength of light, it comes from the sun, so we get it naturally, environmentally. But what we've learned from research over time is that shorter wavelengths of light, which come from the sun as well, cause burning of the skin without really helping psoriasis very much. And longer wavelengths of light, which could cause damage to the skin as well, don't help psoriasis very much either. And so that's why we have what's called narrow band phototherapy. Now, it is ultraviolet light, so one needs to protect their eyes when they're getting this treatment, so that way you don't cause a burn on the eyes or cause cataracts. And then, with short-term use, if the dose is not adjusted just right, a patient could have a sunburn-like reaction. That's usually pretty mild when it comes down to it. It's very rare that we need to treat that with any medical therapy beyond just some moisturizers. And then, in theory, with long-term use, if patients are treated for years and years, and they have fair skin, they may have more premature aging of the skin, more freckles and wrinkles, if you will. And in theory, they may have a higher risk of skin cancer, although interestingly, studies to date really haven't demonstrated higher rates of skin cancer in patients getting this type of treatment.
Thank you, Dr. Gelfand. My next question and last one before I actually bring on the panel is on comorbidities. So we have evidence that shows an association of psoriasis with a number of comorbidities ranging from arthritis, depression, to cardiovascular disease, sleep apnea, to lifestyle-linked issues of smoking, alcoholism, skin cancer. I believe the list is almost endless. So Dr. Gelfand, when I was preparing for this talk, it was kind of scary. And you have worked extensively on psoriasis and comorbidities like cardiovascular events related to it. Mm-hmm. It would be great if you could talk about comorbidities and the effect of quality of life with psoriasis patients.
Yeah, so, psoriasis is a very complicated disease where inflammation drives this condition, both in the skin and ultimately in the blood. And so as we've learned more about inflammation over the last couple of decades in medicine, we've learned that many conditions that are seemingly unrelated actually have similar pathways of inflammation that drive them. So insulin resistance, which causes diabetes, actually there's types of inflammation that promote that that are similar to psoriasis inflammation. Similarly, cardiovascular disease, atherosclerosis, or hardening of the arteries, it's not just things like cholesterol that cause that problem, but it's the body's immune response to cholesterol in the vessels that results in atherosclerosis and ultimately cardiovascular events. So there seems to be some shared pathophysiology between psoriasis and some of these comorbidities that we're observing to be at a higher frequency in our patients. I think what we've learned from the research over the last decade or so is a couple of things. One is there tends to be a dose response. For people who have very limited psoriasis, mild psoriasis, the rates of these comorbidities may be slightly elevated, but it's small enough where we don't think it's that clinically important. That's except, of course, for psoriatic arthritis, where that can be common in people with mild psoriasis and be quite severe in the joints. That said, as the psoriasis gets more severe, as you have more of your body surface area involved with psoriasis, you have a higher risk of developing things like diabetes or cardiovascular events or psoriatic arthritis. And so, on one level, this could sound a little bit scary to patients and those who care for them. But on the other hand, it's really an opportunity. But many of these comorbidities, we think, have opportunities for prevention. So, for example, if someone has psoriasis, they know that means that they may have higher rates of abnormal lipids or diabetes or cardiovascular events over time. We can prevent these things by identifying high blood pressure and treating it, treating elevated cholesterol with things like statins, early identification of diabetes and treatment. By applying what we know about cardiovascular prevention to people with psoriasis, it's like we can prevent a lot of these complications in our patients. But we know from a lot of the work that we and others have done that patients with psoriasis tend to be unaware of their traditional cardiovascular risk factors. And when they do have them, they tend to be undertreated. And so to me, this is sort of like a warning signal to a patient and their care team that when someone has a chronic inflammatory disease like psoriasis, there should be extra attention paid towards efforts at prevention.
Thank you, Doctor. And I think being mindful of time, I'm going to bring on the panel. We have with us Howard Chang, who has lived with severe psoriasis and eczema for more than 40 years. He's an active health advocate and featured columnist on Everyday Health, writing The Itch to Beat Psoriasis. Welcome, Howard. Before you start with your questions to Dr. Gelfand, I would like you to share your story with us and also tell our audience the three things that you would, which has helped you in managing your condition.
Okay, thank you so much for having me on this panel. Oh, yes. Hello?
Yes. I can hear you great. I hear you great.
Oh, okay, great. Thank you. And yes, thanks so much for coming on, Dr. Gelfand, to just shed some light on psoriasis and just to help answer our questions as patients and advocates. So my journey really started when I was a child, and I really appreciate the discussion about pediatric psoriasis. You know, 40 years ago, treatments that I went through and everything that I've experienced since, I could really relate to a lot of what Dr. Gelfand was talking about in terms of different treatments and so forth. I was diagnosed at 8 years old. I had a strep throat, so we talked about how infection can be a trigger. And I had a strep throat, I had high fever, and I got that guttate psoriasis just broke out all over my body. And so, we went to see a dermatologist, and they said I had psoriasis, and then they sent me over to UCSF, University of California, San Francisco, to confirm that diagnosis, which they did. So, I had psoriasis at that young age in elementary school and faced a lot of bullying, low self-esteem. I developed a lot of social anxiety from it, especially as a teenager, having just a lot of my skin covered with disease. When I graduated from high school, when other people were going on graduation trips and preparing for college, I went to the psoriasis treatment daycare center near Stanford for 6 weeks to get this treatment called Anthralin paste. And I don't think we use that anymore, but it was just a really cumbersome and not very effective treatment. So just really painful experience there. When I went to college, I started systemic treatments. So I started taking pills, again, methotrexate. And back then, they had me doing liver biopsies. So, I had the experience of doing that. And as I hit certain amount of treatment with methotrexate, and then I was on etrednate and acitretin, which the doctor had mentioned before. But about 13 years ago, I really faced my worst flare. I was about 95% covered. My doctor had no more options. I was using secondary, tertiary treatments, third-line treatments, and nothing was working. I was depressed. I wanted to quit my job. I wanted to quit my life. It was just a really pretty desperate situation. So they got me to back to UCSF. Back where it all started for me, and Dr. John Koo, he could talk to me and help me out. It was a very emotional experience just to know that there were options. So I ended up going on cyclosporin at the time, and then later some biologics came out. I've been on 6 biologics since. I'm on my 6th one right now. Started about a half a year ago on a new one, Skyrizi. And it's just been a journey of trying to heal my skin, but also emotional and spiritual healing. A big part of that for me was blogging and getting involved with the National Psoriasis Foundation in volunteering patient advocacy, speaking in Sacramento or Washington, D.C., just writing and joining panels and just trying to help others to redeem this experience that I've had. But it's been a crazy journey in terms of how the treatments have come along over 40 years as well. So it's really great to be where we are now, and I'm really grateful for all the great research and all the great work that doctors like Dr. Gelfand and other researchers have done over the years.
Yeah, Howard, I want to say your story is really inspirational to us, to me in particular. I personally have a lot of admiration for people who have to live with psoriasis. It does create a lot of challenges for patients, and patients are often misunderstood. The general public often doesn't understand what psoriasis is. There's still lots of myths out there about being contagious or things of that nature, which it absolutely is not. And so it's inspiring for us to hear your story and how you've progressed through the years. And I think we're still making lots of progress in psoriasis, but there's still plenty of patients who struggle mightily with the disease and may respond well to a biologic, but then may lose response over time and may have to try another biologic. And so I think that those of us in the research community and the medical community are excited about the progress we've made, but know that we haven't solved the problem yet and are working diligently to move towards a cure or find better ways to treat people so they have long-term control.
No, yeah, thank you so much. It's really amazing, like I said, the advancements and the just being part of the community and seeing the dedication of the patients, the advocates, and our doctors and our researchers. So thanks so much. I think this is a story that, as I talk to other patients and other advocates that, we've gone through similar journeys and they were telling me that, when we used to get together way back when, there was a lot of depression and just pessimism, mm-hmm. but with a lot more optimism now. It's come a long way. Yeah. So Priya had asked me three kind of suggestions or tips. And so the first thing I thought, so should I go through my three ways to manage psoriasis? Yeah.
Yes. That.
Okay. Yeah, sure. So the first one for me was just getting educated. I think about back when, before the internet, before anything that we could, get information easily as we can now, it was hard to get educated. I got pamphlets from the National Psoriasis Foundation. I was trying to learn as much as I could, but now there's a lot of great information on the internet to learn about the condition, to learn about all the great treatments that are out there and just the options and just to learn about yourself, too, just how your body, your condition responds to different environments, potential triggers, treatments, and so forth. So the first thing for me was just to get educated and just take that step. It's nothing to be afraid of. And the more you know, the better you can treat and manage the condition, which, is my second one, similar, is get treated. Dr. Galvin said that a lot of people are still suffering. There are a lot of great options out there. So, to work closely with your doctor. I've had some great relationships with my dermatologists. We work closely together, and they really listen to kind of my concerns, my condition. They take my history. So just getting treated, it sounds simple, but it kind of can solve a lot of the problems just to take that step if you're not getting treated right now. And then the last one for me was to get connected. So, for many years, again, without the internet and without being connected to a local support group or advocacy group, I was very lonely. And one of the comments that I've gotten over the years, maybe less so recently, was that people saying that they thought that they were the only one or they felt so alone with psoriasis. That's just a horrible way to go when you've got lesions and all over your body, or maybe you're dealing with, depression or anxiety and just feeling like there's no one out there who understands you. So I think being able to get connected, there's National Psoriasis Foundation is a group that I've been a part of. There are a lot of events locally, fundraising events, there are online groups and resources. And so those, I think, help us get inspired by others who have gone before to help us connect others who go through the similar things that we go through. So get educated, get treated, and get connected.
Thank you, Albert. I think that's really very apt and very helpful for people who are listening. So Albert says get educated, get treated, and get connected if you want to manage your psoriasis well. Albert, please ask your questions to Dr. Galvin. I'm sure I know you have some great questions. Yeah.
I have so many questions. Actually, we talked about treatments and biologics, and I recently read about how we may have a personalized biologic treatment, that you could just go to a patient and know which biologic might be effective. Like, I've tried six, and it's kind of a frustrating process,
yes.
Doctor. What is your take on the state of psoriasis treatments being tailored to individual patients, and how far away do you think we are from a cure? I know it's a hard question, but just kind of your sense of the researchers.
Yeah, so let me take the question about cure first, and then we'll talk about individual treatment second. So if you were to ask me, is there a chance we could cure this disease 10 years ago, I would have said, no, there's no way we could cure it. These are so complicated diseases, and I don't think there's a chance of curing it. Now, 10 years later, we've learned so much more. Specifically, we've learned what are the actual proteins in the skin that the immune system is reacting to. So we now know what's called the antigen, or what's inciting this problem. And we also know fundamentally that the immune pathways involved in this disease state, IL-23, which promotes differentiation of immune cells, T cells, into Th17 cells, which release a cytokine called IL-17. This pathway was barely understood 15, 20 years ago, you know, and now all of a sudden we have therapies out that are, you know, highly effective and rapidly beneficial in patients with psoriasis. They're not cures, of course, but they are highly effective treatments for many patients. Some of the questions are, why do some patients, like you're explaining your experience, why do some patients, you know, respond great and others don't respond so well? We don't know the answer to that perfectly yet. Some data suggests that, in fact, you know, most patients, close to all patients, should respond well to medications that target IL-23 or IL-17, but that people vary a lot in terms of how much of a dose of the drug they need. So one hypothesis would be that, well, if you didn't do well on, let's just pick a drug, say ixekizumab, like you had a partial response but didn't clear, well, maybe you need twice the dose or three times the dose or four times the dose. You know, this is a hypothesis that needs to be tested. But some data suggest that. And the reason why we think this is because people have done these sort of elegant studies where if you take patients who, you know, had very severe psoriasis, went in one of these targeted biologics, and then they only had, you know, three or four plaques left, if you biopsy those plaques and look at their genetic profile and immunologic profile, that is run-of-the-mill psoriasis. There's nothing unique to it, suggesting that the issue is that not enough of the biologic is getting to that particular patch in the skin to interrupt the inflammation that's going there. All right, so now moving on to personalized therapy. So this is certainly broader in medicine, a very eager area of investigation. Some fields are more apt to be successful in that area. So cancer, for example. You know, in cancer, you will often have, you know, two or three mutations in the cancer itself that drugs specifically target. In psoriasis, that's trickier because it's often, you know, multiple genetic pathways that are driving multiple different immunological pathways, and therefore there may not be sort of a silver bullet, you know, a single approach that would knock out all those different pathways of inflammation that are active in that individual. So, you know, currently the standard of care is we don't have any tests we can order to decide that we should use biologic A versus biologic B or pill A versus pill, you know, C. That's just not available, but there's certainly a lot of research trying to move us closer in that direction.
No, that would be incredible. Yeah, just doing this trial and error over the years, and you have to wait 2 or 3 months, and then you have to try something else, and sometimes you're getting worse. Hasn't happened to me as much recently, but over the years I've faced that. So this kind of area is pretty interesting to me.
You know, we're hoping that with the newer, more targeted biologics, the IL-17s and the 23s, that will be a less common experience for patients.
Yes.
But there's still likely to be patients who still have that same experience where it doesn't seem to work or it works and then stops working. And that's the larger problem our patients tend to face now is that they do well on a biologic, but over time they start losing response. And, you know, our goal for our patient is to be able to treat them with a medication safely and have long-term control of their disease so they they remain in remission for many years. And we haven't achieved that goal for the majority of our patients yet.
Mm. Yes. You know, I think another area besides, you know, biologics and kind of the traditional medicines, it seems like, you know, alternative medications, especially diet, is a big discussion in the psoriasis community. Can you speak to diet or supplements, and do you have any advice for people living with psoriasis in terms of, you know, food intake and so forth?
Sure. So, you know, the best data out there so far related to diet is really around weight loss. And so for those who are overweight, and by overweight, I mean a body mass index of greater than 30, and that's based on your weight divided by height. And one could just go online to calculate your BMI, this Google, you know, calculate my BMI calculators will come up, and you can figure out what your body mass index is. So people who have high BMIs, and a lot of our patients with psoriasis do, put them in the medical category of obesity. When they lose weight, their psoriasis gets less severe. They respond better to treatments that they're on. Those effects, though, are relatively modest and very difficult to obtain because, as you can imagine, it's very hard to lose weight and then to maintain weight loss. For patients with severe obesity, when they have BMIs over 40, I often talk to my patients about considering things like bariatric surgery. Because we know in those patients, bariatric surgery will lower their risk of diabetes and arthritis over time. But there's also a good deal of reports in the literature of people with bad psoriasis who have had bariatric surgery, lost a lot of weight, and their psoriasis got much, much better. And in my clinical experience, that's been the case as well. Now, coming to specific diets, things like gluten-free diets or anti-inflammatory diets, in my view, these are largely anecdotal at this point in time, without real clear proof that they are clinically beneficial for patients. And so I don't recommend this to my patients. Most importantly, I don't want patients to feel guilty that it's their diet and how they eat that's causing their disease. I mean, ultimately, this is an autoimmune disease that was triggered, and changes in diet really that are geared towards weight loss could have some modest benefits, but that alone doesn't make a major difference for patients. Other alternative health approaches have shown some evidence at a rigorous level in terms of clinical trials. There's some data that mindfulness meditation can be helpful for patients. There was a study done in the 1990s by John Kabat-Zinn, who's a world expert in meditation and a clinical psychologist. And what he showed is that patients who were listening to meditation tapes while getting phototherapy, compared to patients listening to regular music tapes, that those with the meditation approach cleared faster and required fewer treatments. So there's some decent data that meditation helps, and that could also help with things like anxiety and help with concentration. So the book I tend to recommend is called Wherever You Go, There You Are by John Kabat-Zinn. It's a nice introduction to meditation techniques, but there's certainly lots of resources out there about mindfulness meditation that people can look at. The last thing I want to mention to our audience is that over the history of the field of psoriasis, we've had lots of examples of things that were thought to be herbal remedies for psoriasis that seemed to be very, very effective, and only later were determined to be laced with potent steroids like clobetasol. And so we do have to caution you know, our patients and those listening that if you're using something that's not been, you know, approved by the FDA, it's an over-the-counter or herbal remedy, and it works really, really well, you know, sometimes that may be because it actually has active medical ingredients in there that may not be safe to be taking on a long-term basis. So I think some caution is indicated here, and it's very important to speak to your healthcare team, your doctors, about, you know, what supplements or alternative therapies you're trying, so we're fully aware of what's going on.
Yeah, that is so helpful because there's so many different you know, so-called treatments that are out there, and they hit the community, and I think people can be desperate at times, or they don't want to try certain medications, and so I think people can get taken advantage of. So one thing we always say is, you know, if it works for you, but it doesn't necessarily work for other people, And yeah, so this is an area I hope you can have a little more studies on too, because I feel like we've heard about a psoriasis diet ever since I was a kid.
Right. Yes. Right.
Yeah. So, you know, one area that's really interesting to me in my blogging and advocacy is kind of bringing awareness to the impact of the disease on the whole person. You know, we talk about quality of life issues, you know, anxiety or depression or relationships, social impacts. What does current research say about how psoriasis impacts quality of life? Is this something that is measurable? And do you have any suggestions for those living with psoriasis or for those who care for them to address quality of life concerns
yeah.
that they might have?
Well, certainly there's been a lot of research in this area over the last couple of decades, and I'll speak in general terms of what we learned. So one is, you know, there's a time when the broader community thought, oh, psoriasis is not a serious disease. And the data on comorbidities and also quality of life have dispelled that myth. There was a time when certain insurance companies would not even cover treatments for psoriasis at all, saying it wasn't medically necessary to treat. And so we've come a long way from those days, which were only about 20 years ago, actually. So we know that psoriasis can have significant impairments on people's quality of life, meaning their mental and physical functioning, and that the symptoms can be as severe as other major medical illnesses like diabetes, for example. We know that younger people and women tend to be more affected on quality of life measures compared to older individuals or men, although, again, that's I wouldn't want to generalize that. Each individual's journey is unique and different in terms of how disease affects themselves. And then, you know, oftentimes the burden of the disease to the patient may not be perceived well by the physician. So oftentimes a doctor may think the disease is mild, but the patient thinks it's severe, or the physician thinks the disease is severe, the patient thinks it's mild. And so it's very important to have that conversation between the doctor and patient, where the patient should help the doctor understand, this is how this disease affects my life. You know, I can't wear clothes, I can't go to the beach, I can't sleep at night because I'm itching, it's affecting my ability to work because I'm in sales, or whatever specific things that are affecting the patient. It's really important to bring it to the doctor's attention so they know the degree of urgency necessary to control those symptoms or improve them. I think the advice that you gave before, get educated. So I think knowledge is power, understanding what's going on in your body, what psoriasis is, I think is extremely empowering and necessary. I think, getting treated, and by getting treated, I mean, having a care team who has expertise in psoriasis, understands your disease state, understands all the treatment options available and can make them available to you, I think is very important. And I think getting connected, as you said, is extremely helpful because, there's over 8 million people with psoriasis in the U.S., over 125 million people worldwide, and that really helps a lot. People with psoriasis, because of the stigmatizing effects of the disease, often feel socially isolated, and that's a really tough way to go through life, a tough way to feel. I have some patients, when I ask them, about bad psoriasis, they'll say, well, what does your wife think about your psoriasis? And they'll say, we never even talked about it. So these conversations can be very hard, even in people with their loved ones to discuss. But we know that people feel better when they're connected to others, when they're understood what they're going through. And so I think that idea of getting connected both to your family, your friends, and the broader community brings a lot of relief and mutual understanding for patients.
Dr. Gelson and Howard, I want to probably bring on David Stanley. So we have David also on the panel. David is a writer, teacher, actor, narrator, and a melanoma survivor, and he's an advocate of skin disorders. David's book on his melanoma journey, titled It Started With a Freckle, is available on Amazon. So, David, please join the panel and the discussion, and please ask your questions.
Sure. Thank you, Priya. Always a pleasure. And Howard, by the way, that's an incredible story. We need to connect because I'd love to hear more of that. But in the meantime,
thank you.
Yeah. I'll, we can track each other down. Doctor, you know, as Priya said, my lay expertise is in melanoma, but several people, when I announced that I was going to be on this panel, reached out to me, unrelated to melanoma issues, of course, and they were saying, well, I have scleroderma, and I have psoriasis. Could you ask them if there's some relationship here, and if there's some, you know, what sort of outcome, what sort of, I guess they're looking for a little ray of hope in what is a horrible autoimmune disease, and then psoriasis piled on.
Yeah. Well, you know, scleroderma is a very tough condition. For those who are listening who aren't familiar with it, it's a sclerosing condition where the skin and sometimes the organs become scarred down or fibrotic, and it could be really devastating to mobility or to organ function, a very challenging problem and a very difficult thing to treat. And so, you know, I think when people have two different autoimmune diseases at the same time, be it psoriasis and scleroderma or psoriasis and lupus or psoriasis and inflammatory bowel disease, you know, it's very important that they be treated in a multidisciplinary environment, you know, having a care team that understands all aspects of these disease states, so that way a treatment can be selected that benefits both diseases. So, for example, a patient I just saw a few days ago who developed severe scalp psoriasis while on infliximab for her Crohn's disease, which was on for 10 years. And so we were able to switch her from infliximab to ustekinumab, which works both for Crohn's disease and for psoriasis. And so now her gut is under good control, and her skin is cleared up. And so she's you know, back to her normal self at this point in time. And so that's the key, is to understand how the therapies interact with these different disease states. There's some drugs that you may want to avoid. For example, if someone has you know, multiple sclerosis, an autoimmune disease, and psoriasis, we would avoid things like TNF inhibitors, like adalimumab, for example, which we know can aggravate multiple sclerosis.
I really have three more questions here that I want to toss out to you in the last couple of minutes that we have. I'm here in Flint, Michigan. You're in Philly, temperate zone. We get 102 degree temps in the summer, and right now 20 degrees in the winter. Can we talk for a few minutes? Can you talk for a few minutes about weather as triggers for psoriatic flare-ups?
You know, weather is certainly a trigger for many patients with psoriasis. When the weather gets colder and drier, the skin is itchier for a lot of people. Scratching the skin or rubbing the skin creates a phenomenon we call the Kebner phenomena, where essentially when we scratch our skin, that's like a signal to the body's immune system that something's wrong, and then it triggers psoriasis in those patches. When the weather's warmer, especially in the influence of ultraviolet light, that tends to be helpful for people with psoriasis. Now, ultraviolet light, as we talked about earlier, from the sun, is not always effective enough on its own, and we know that because we have ultraviolet centers in Hawaii and Florida. And so we know that the medical use of ultraviolet light, where it's a single wave of the light, what we call 311, that's much more effective for controlling psoriasis. And so for a lot of my patients who prefer intermittent treatment, they may come in for a course of light therapy, you know, in the spring or the winter to get disease controlled, but then they can stop it in the summer. They're pretty mild anyway with natural sunlight and better weather. And some of my patients choose the same approach with their oral medications or their biologics.
Two more questions, and then I'll hand it back over to Priya. My background actually is in zoology. I've done a lot of genetics work. Can you talk for a few more minutes? You opened the show with that, about whether or not, in your view, the expense involved in genetic counseling is worthwhile as a predictor for psoriasis and offspring.
Well, I think that's important for patients to be aware of what the genetic underpinnings of psoriasis are. So one is, as I mentioned earlier, about 40% of people have a family history of psoriasis. That means most do not have a family history. And so that's often reassuring to patients, but some patients feel like, well, why am I the only one in my family that has to deal with psoriasis? Well, that is the nature of the complexity of the genetic patterns of this disease state, and that's a normal part of this disease experience. And then the second thing is, a lot of my patients, you know, will say, you know, I'm so devastated by my psoriasis, I would never want to have a child who had to deal with the same psoriasis. And for those patients, I help them understand that one is that the likelihood that a child will develop psoriasis over their lifetime is still relatively low, probably about 20% or so. that certain things could be done to lower their risk of developing psoriasis, like if they maintain a healthy body weight and don't smoke, that lowers the risk of developing psoriasis over time. And then also, typically, if one person has severe psoriasis, you know, the children may have mild psoriasis and may be less impactful for them. And then finally, look at all the progress we're making. You know, my patients always like to say, I don't have my dad's psoriasis, you know, because now we have so many better options now. And so, you know, I hope my patients feel reassured that they want to have children, that they should go ahead and have biologic children if they wish to, and not think of psoriasis as a limiting factor in that respect.
Okay, my last question, and you did touch on this for a few moments. Priya mentioned this as well. There was that big comorbidity study that was released, I think, back in like October or so, maybe September, about psoriasis and comorbidity. Can you speak to that and some specific kinds of cancers and what you think the future is for that sort of research, that sort of relationship as a predictor?
So we covered some of that ground earlier, so I'll touch on some new points that you brought up. One is in the realm of cancer. I think generally speaking, the best data suggests that people with psoriasis probably are not more prone to cancer in general. That some of the cancers we pick up may be due to other factors like obesity or smoking or alcohol use, for example. Certain types of cancers like lymphoma seem to be more related to psoriasis. We think that chronic inflammation could promote lymphoma, but that risk is pretty low, and therefore patients really shouldn't be too alarmed by that information. Clinicians need to know that sometimes a type of lymphoma of the skin called T-cell lymphoma or a cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, that could often look like psoriasis, so we need to make sure we have the right diagnosis for our patients. But again, that's a pretty uncommon thing for people to have to worry about. And then, you know, patients should take advantage of what we know helps lower the risk of complications from cancer. So colonoscopy screening of cancer when you're in your late 40s or early 50s, mammograms for women when they're in their 50s or older, sometimes in the 40s, those type of screening modalities can do a lot to lower a patient's risk of developing a cancer that could be treated early and preventing a bad outcome.
This just popped in my head as I was listening to you. One of the things that's going on right now in melanoma research are RNA inhibitors to inhibit that pathway. Do you know if any research that's going on in that sort of area with psoriasis treatments?
Yes, there are a variety of approaches under investigation, either at the very basic level, like animal model level, or starting to get towards human studies, where people are looking at things like epigenetic regulation, RNA regulation of inflammation. So those are pathways that are being evaluated by companies and scientists.
Very cool. All right. Thank you, Dr. Priya. Those are my questions. Back over to you.
Thank you, David. Thank you very much. Dr. Gelfand, we can take some questions from the audience. I see many more on light therapy. So I'm just going to pick one, which says, how effective is BAL neophototherapy for psoriasis?
BAL neophototherapy, which is essentially like going to the Dead Sea, for example, soaking in water and an ultraviolet light. Mm-hmm. It could be pretty effective, but obviously pretty inconvenient. Medical phototherapy in our hands is quite effective. We published a paper in one of our journals, the Journal of the American Academy of Dermatology, where use of phototherapy was about as effective as treatment with a biologic called adalimumab, which is a pretty effective therapy. Now, of course, treatment's always individual for patients, and so for some patients it's not as effective as in others. And then the other issue is that with phototherapy, when you stop it, the disease comes back. And so for some patients, it's not a great choice because some people don't want that sort of yo-yo effect where it's like their skin is clear, but then it starts coming back again, and then it's clear again, and it starts coming back. That's part of the reason why we're doing this study of home phototherapy versus office phototherapy. This is called the LIGHT Study, funded by the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute, or PCORI, to see if we can make the delivery of phototherapy more patient-centered, where the treatment is done in their house using a home unit. And we think that's likely to be as effective and safe as what's done in the office, but that research is ongoing now.
Okay, thank you, doctor. Just we have a minute more, so I'm going to just have a wrap-up question for you, Dr. Gelfin. It'd be great if you could talk about some of your research and what the future treatments of psoriasis look like.
Yeah, so I think our, you know, the biggest things we're working on currently is a series of clinical trials designed to better understand the effects our therapies have on the cardiovascular system, trying to understand what they do to inflammation in the arteries, what they do to how our body processes cholesterol, the effects they have on atherosclerosis. So that work will continue to emerge, and hopefully we'll have a better understanding over time if whether or not we're able to lower cardiovascular risk just by treating psoriasis through our therapies. A second major form of research is better understanding how ultraviolet light therapy delivered in a more patient-centered manner could work, and hopefully through that research we're doing, it's a study of 1,050 patients across the United States. Hopefully we'll be able to shift care to be more patient-centered so more patients could have access to a highly effective therapy that could be done at home on their own schedule. We also continue to do these large population studies where we're following people with psoriasis of varying disease severities to understand how body surface area predicts health outcomes over time. That will give patients, you know, more empowerment so they can understand, well, you know, what are my risks given my individual psoriasis severity? What do I need to be concerned about? And I think more broadly, you know, the community is continuing to advance work in biologics as new biologics being investigated that may have even higher efficacy compared to what we have in the market currently. There are small molecules, things that are pills that can be taken by mouth that may improve upon the efficacy of what we have currently available on the market. So, you know, stay tuned. You know, each week there's roughly 50 to 70 new scientific publications in the peer-reviewed literature about psoriasis. Knowledge is expanding rapidly, and with that expanding knowledge, so is the treatment landscape we have to offer our patients.
Thank you very much, Dr. Gelfand. The audience, psoriasis is one of the most common skin ailments affecting about 2% of the population across gender, age, or socioeconomic status. The impact of this autoimmune skin condition goes much deeper with the, as we heard, raised cardiovascular disease, inflammatory arthritis, and other immune system-related conditions. However, as Dr. Gelfand was saying, a lot of research is going on, new drugs are coming in, so this has made management of the condition better. Dr. Gelfand, thank you so very much for your time and all the information that you've shared with us and our audience today. David and Howard, thank you for participating and for those great questions, bringing in the patient's perspective. We also thank the University of Pennsylvania and its Office of Clinical Research. This talk will be available on curetalks.com. Please visit our website for details on upcoming talks. Thank you, everyone, and have a great day.
Thanks.